This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, and it's a pleasure to have you on our radio Main Street all across North Dakota this time of day. And this Main Street is a special one. We do this once a month. It's time for our Editor's Roundtable, and that means that our veteran in Bismarck, our news director Dave Thompson, is standing by our studio there. Hello, Dave.
Hi there, Doug.
On the phone from Grand Forks, Mike Jacobs, the former editor and publisher of the Grand Forks Herald, still a columnist. Mike, thank you for joining us.
You bet. I'm here.
And Joe Radsky's with me here in the Fargo studio. Joe is the news director for KVRR Television. Let's talk.
My neighbors would be unhappy if I didn't point out that I'm actually in Gilby or near Gilby.
Thank you. That is important. Because Gilby is important to the history of the newspaper too, isn't it?
Kind of. Yeah, it's the center of the universe, don't you know?
Of course. Well, thanks for that correction, Mike, and Gilby is where you are. Let's start with this brand new presidential library that may be getting built in the western edge of North Dakota, Dave.
At Medora. Basically, the governor signed the bill into law this afternoon. It was part of his budget bill. One of the trade-outs to get it is that he has to take his $284,000 salary, but that's another story. But it is a $150 million project, at least the way it's envisioned. $50 million has been created as an endowment fund to keep it maintained. $15 million of that would come from general fund dollars that has not been spent in the current biennium. Another $35 million would come from the Bank of North Dakota. So that tells you that they've got that, and that will match $100 in private donations.
Now, that $100 million in private donations, I was given the impression that that was already on the table, but it's like about half of that is actually—
That's what I understand, about half of that.
Okay,
yes.
So there's some fundraising yet to do.
Yes, and who knows? I understand that there's at least been some inquiries from some of the out-of-state firms who are kind of looking at making the investment.
Okay. Well, let's get the eastern edge perspective on this. Mike, what are you thinking about this from Gilby?
I think it is a masterful solution to the problem. It keeps Dickinson whole. It gives Dickinson back the money that the city had invested.
Right,
in
$3 million.
The library there, it guarantees the digitizing of the Roosevelt papers, and they'll be available at Dickinson State, and it pretty much puts the private funders on notice that they're going to have to pony up now because everything is contingent on them at this point.
Mm-hmm. Joe, is anybody talking about it around KVRR?
We don't hear a lot about it, but, you know, having traveled out there for the first time last summer with my wife Jane, it is a gorgeous area, and I just think it will be an incredible addition to that area. But, yeah, I mean, it can't help but bring more notice to the state.
Well, it's an interesting project in that it is sort of uniquely situated in a part of the country that has Yellowstone Park far to the south, and it's got, of course, the Black Hills not that far to the south. So maybe this is sort of a route that tourists will take. Who knows?
At least that's the expectation. And I have to interject.
Well, it's not the expectation. It's the promise.
Uh-huh. The promise, yes. That's true.
It was clear that the governor and the people behind this proposal believe it's going to happen. There was a fair bit of skepticism was expressed, particularly early in the process.
Right.
But it was overcome in the end.
Well, it's certainly a huge investment in Medora.
It is. And the library itself is going to be built at the entrance to the park. At least that's the plan. And they're hoping that that will spur the National Park Service to redo its visitor center there. And the whole opening of the park right there.
And that's right off Interstate 94. Is that what you're talking about?
No, the one that's downtown.
Oh, I see. Okay. Because there was some talk about maybe using that one vista as possible exit.
And Governor Burgum in an interview today said that he would like to see some money go eventually to that to maybe redo that rest area out there at Painted Canyon.
Okay.
I do have to interject, and Mike will get a kick out of this. In the House debate, a lawmaker who never, ever speaks on a bill.
I was there, actually.
You were there. Never, ever speaks on a bill, actually got up and spoke, and that's Representative Bob Martinson from Bismarck. He had a wonderful speech, a lot of laughing about it, and the people who were in the House said he probably flipped maybe 15 to 20 votes after he got done.
I, I think that's true, because just before the debate started, Republican leadership was confident of about 50, 55 votes, which would have been enough for a majority, but not for the supermajority that eventually guaranteed that this project can start without threat of a referral.
Yeah, it was interesting that this start when this the governor was proposing this. You know, there was a lot of back and forth, and it, occasionally we'd think, "Well, it's off the session schedule now; it's gone away." But it's back, and it's back in a big way.
Back in a big way, signed and sealed and delivered now.
All right. Well, let's talk about this ethics measure that became part of the Constitution. I guess it's Article 14 now, to provide an ethics commission. This has been hotly debated in the legislature, Dave.
Very hotly debated. We had two competing bills. One was in the Senate that was introduced by Senator Mathern from Fargo. And, of course, the one in the House was the leadership bill. The one in the House is the one that actually has been compromised and into a form that they think is at least a blueprint for further study. The second bill, which was the Mathern bill, has gone into a study.
Well, what about this whistleblower thing, the anonymous versus confidential tip from a whistleblower?
Right. The bill that was passed says if you are wanting to be a confidential whistleblower, you have to give your name and address. And the supporters say it's because the U.S. Constitution says you have a right to confront your accuser. And some of the opponents of this are saying, wait a second, that doesn't go with the spirit because this is a confidential whistleblower line. But, you know, if anonymous tips are found, does that mean they can't investigate them? So I have a feeling there may be some tweaking yet probably in the next 2 years to do.
And, Mike, they're leaving a lot of this up to the Ethics Commission, which has yet to be named.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, they're asking for applications. It'll be interesting to see whether anybody really wants to be on it.
That'll be interesting, yes.
It'll be a little bit like the Board of Higher Education.
Yeah, there you go. Well, we'll be getting to that as well. But this Ethics Commission, is it going to actually be in existence the next time the legislature convenes?
That's the hope. And I understand from people who are involved that there were five applicants so far, and a couple of people approached me in the session today saying, how do I apply to get on? So there might be some interest there. And you have to go to the governor's website and fill out a form there and submit a resume. And what the governor is going to do, the governor is going to get the recommendations from the Senate, I believe, majority leaders and minority leaders.
In the meantime, the people who put together that successful initiated constitutional measure will be watching all of this activity, you know, with an eye toward possibly taking some legal action if they don't like the direction it's going.
That's right. That's exactly right.
Okay. Let's talk about the constitutional amendment piece of this, too, while we're talking about initiated measures. Of course, that was an initiated measure to change the North Dakota Constitution. And Dave, lo and behold, the legislature might want to – was looking at changing that process.
Yes, and they have approved an amendment that will go on the ballot next November. And that amendment says if an initiated constitutional measure passes, then the legislature gets a chance to review it.
November of 2020.
November 2020 when that goes – then if they would pass it, if the voters would pass it, the legislature would take a look at this measure. And if the legislature didn't like it, well, then it'd go back on the ballot. And if the voters pass it again, well, then it'd become law. But the legislature says that gives them a chance to look at it and to hold public hearings. Well, that it's still going to be on the ballot one way or the other.
Huh. Well, it's an interesting development because the whole idea of initiated measures in the state it seems to be one that the residents embrace wholeheartedly, and the legislature seems to want to kind of cool that a bit.
And now there's a potentially a competing measure that could be on the ballot that is an initiated measure, basically saying the legislature can't mess with Article 3 of the Constitution. And that, to me, brings up a question. What – and I'm just doing a what if – what if – in November 2020, both these measures are on the ballot and both pass.
Uh-huh. Well, what if somebody wanted to put in an initiated constitutional measure that you can't change the Constitution?
That's it. That's exactly it.
So yes. I guess there's a circular argument there somewhere. Let's go up north to Grand Forks, where you are, not too far away, in Gilby, Mike, and talk about the leadership of the University of North Dakota. That is in disarray.
I wouldn't use that word. It's in transition.
Okay.
It's a great opportunity for the university. I think the members of the board and the chancellor have indicated that there will be a new president relatively soon, at least an interim president. Candidates are beginning to come forward. There's discussion widely on campus, in the university community, on campus, and in the alumni ranks. So I think that the disarray really was the inability of the incumbent president to respond effectively to provide effective leadership for the situation that existed on campus. He did some good things. He managed to upset quite a few people in the process. It will be interesting. Tomorrow evening is the annual Champions Ball celebrating UND athletic success, such as it is at the moment. There will be a lot of alums with checkbooks there. So it will be interesting to see what their reaction is.
Well, Joe, your news team was up in Grand Forks yesterday for an event that acknowledged a member of the Ingolstadt family, which is a major funder of UND's hockey program in particular, and some academic as well. And describe the reception.
Well, it was a week ago, but yes, the daughter of Ralph Ingolstadt was given an award and did not choose to speak about Mr. Kennedy at the time, but then spoke later to the newspaper. But today,
the name of the newspaper is the Grand Forks Herald.
The Grand Forks Herald, yeah, right. Yeah.
That voice from Gilby again.
Sorry,
yeah.
My instinct is not to mention it, but yes. But no. But today here in Fargo, Governor Burgum stated emphatically that it's time to go, time for Kennedy to go.
Mike, I'm a little curious about this. Do you think that Mark Kennedy was going to the University of Colorado, looking at their offer because he was thinking his days were numbered at UND, or did he just slip up in the whole process?
No, I think that his record here is that he was almost from the beginning looking for a different position, and that was clear in his application after less than a year on campus, or very little more than a year on campus at Central Florida, where he was a finalist. And then now, about a year later at Colorado. So, he's ambitious and really didn't see North Dakota as where he expected to spend his entire academic career. Now, he has said that he has told Colorado that he intends to stay.
In North Dakota, if they...
No, in Colorado.
Oh, I see. I got you. He's giving them that assurance, I take
yes,
it.
Yes.
Yeah, he spoke just the other day to a group of students and tried to convince them that his politics had changed 180 from when he was a politician. And I don't know if many of the students were buying that.
Well, he is...
Well, there are no students who get to vote. So.
Yeah, it's the Regents, true. And the Regents yeah. share, in many ways, his ideology. But
that, well, and not only that, it's clear that in Colorado, the political situation is deeply divided.
Mm-hmm.
They're basically unable to govern themselves at the moment because of the situation in the legislature. So both sides are looking for those wedge issues that will bring them more votes. And I think that one of the issues that they're negotiating is the next congressional election, the next general election, is a congressional election. Donald Trump will likely be on the ballot, and so they're looking to make the Republicans are looking to make this an issue, and Kennedy's congressional record is pretty much in keeping with what if not current Republican orthodoxy is, it's not very far off.
Well,
he's a Republican conservative.
He is, and he also, took over the seat that was held by Michelle Bachmann. So he's a
actually the other way around. Michelle Bachmann took over the seat that he had.
That's right. Sorry about that.
But that tells you a little bit about the district, doesn't it?
They're in the same district, yeah. Let's talk about the possibility of a replacement, because a prominent name's been thrown out, and obviously there's a long process yet to hang out there. But Heidi Heitkamp, his name, is out there now. Is that anything that interests people at UND?
I think it's extremely unlikely. I think that the campus community is looking for leadership that is fully conversant with the situation, both on campus and in Grand Forks and in Bismarck, Heidi Heitkamp is she certainly does love the university, as she says, but she's not been on campus in any kind of leadership capacity, The number of employees at the University of North Dakota is vastly more than she's ever managed in a political campaign or a Senate office or in an Attorney General's office. Just to review her career in reverse,
Dave.
I think it's unlikely.
Dave, you're a UND grad, mm-hmm. so and you are in Bismarck, and you're listening about the swirl that's going on in the legislature. And every time that there's an opening, particularly for one of our major universities in North Dakota, the two big ones, there's a lot of talking about, well, shouldn't we get a home state person?
I heard that a lot when we first heard about Kennedy. As a matter of fact, there was a lot of wagging of tongues among legislators, but then again, that's probably de rigueur during a legislative session.
Okay.
What I'm hearing Mike say, and Mike, am I reading you wrong, that there is some feeling that maybe promotion from within?
I think there is a short list, and it includes a couple of names that are on campus. It includes a couple of names who have close connections with UND. There have been some recent retirees who might be considered for an interim. It depends on whether the board and particularly the chancellor actually has the power to make this decision. He'd have to consult, but it depends on whether they want a short interim and then get somebody in here as quickly as possible on a permanent basis, or whether they're going to go for a longer interim. Conduct their own search and try to get past the chaos on the ballot in November of 2020, when the whole structure of the Board of Higher Education is on the ballot. And again, just like the Ethics Commission or the Constitutional Revision Amendments, there could be more than one higher education governance amendment on the ballot in 2020. So there is a period of uncertainty ahead for the whole system, and that doesn't really mean a whole lot to students. It probably doesn't mean a whole lot to alums, but it means an awful lot to candidates. Because they want to understand what the governance system is going to be.
Well, there's an experienced interim president of UND. That's Ed Schaefer. Is he a viable candidate?
His name is on the list, and of course so is Heidi Heitkamp's. But again, when you get to people like Governor Schaefer and Senator Heitkamp, neither of them have the academic chops that the campus is hungry for. They want somebody on campus who can refocus, so to speak, the curriculum in a way that takes advantage of that addresses the problems and takes advantages of the opportunities that exist in higher education now. And frankly, likely neither of those two candidates would be at the top of the list if you're looking for someone with a strong academic administrative background. If you're looking for a dean from somewhere, you're looking for a provost from somewhere. You're looking for somebody who can lead a large and complicated academic institution through this transition.
Could they be looking for an ex-editor of the Grand Forks Herald?
Well, the truth is that I joked about this. You probably heard me joking about this in Bismarck.
I did.
The truth is that the publisher of any daily newspaper in the Red River Valley has more experience with administrative and budgeting issues than a U.S. senator does.
Okay, so you're
not that I want not that I'm announcing not that I'm denigrating Heidi Heitkamp's experience in any way. It's just that there are both personnel. When I was at publisher of the Herald, we had 186 employees. A senator's staff is in double digits maybe, but certainly not in triple digits.
Well, let's move on to another institution in the state, the North Dakota State College of Science. They've had this audit that was critical of some procedures there, and now the president, John Richman, and his vice president of workforce affairs, Tony Grinberg, are a bit under the microscope, Dave.
They are. And remember, this audit was released by the state auditor's office. There was an audit and review committee from the Board of Higher Education that took a look. And basically what happened at that meeting is we're going to give President Richman and NDSCS time to respond to this. Their deadline is early May. There's going to be another meeting of that audit committee, and then the Board of Higher Education will take another look at it toward the end of the month in May.
So what's the ultimate outcome here? Somebody gets slapped on the wrist, or what happens?
That's a good question. I don't think I know anything at this point. But
one of the things that strikes me about this is that almost a year ago, the Board of Higher Education held up John Richman's contract.
Yes.
Over similar issues, which at that time had been pretty well covered by the Wahpeton Daily News, but got very little attention beyond that. So this is not the first hint of this issue arising. The other question that comes up here, and Dave, you'll know about this, is the move against the auditor's office.
Yes.
Trying to limit the auditor's power to conduct these independent audits.
Right. And it stems from a line in the budget bill that was added apparently in a late-night session of a conference committee, saying that if the auditor wants to do performance audits, he has to get permission of the Legislative Audit and Fiscal Review Committee, one that has the unfortunate acronym LAFRSI.
Okay. Well, we're holding our monthly editors roundtable. You just heard Dave Thompson, our news director, and of course, Mike Jacobs is with us by phone from Gilby, North Dakota. And here in the studio with me, we've got Joe Radsky from KVRR Television. We'll be back to talk about more of the stories that have been making the headlines as the legislature careens toward adjournment with our editors roundtable after the news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. Governor Burgum has signed into law his budget bill for the upcoming two-year period. In that bill is $50 million to create an endowment fund for a proposed Theodore Roosevelt Library and Museum to be built in Medora. The $50 million consists of $15 million in unspent general fund dollars from the current two-year budget, as well as a $35 million loan from the Bank of North Dakota. The money will be used to attract $100 million in private donations for the library.
I would do a deal like this every day if I thought I could take taxpayer money, put it in an endowment where it never leaves the state's hands, but we create the opportunity for $100 million in fresh capital coming into North Dakota, which is essentially a tourism factory. I mean, it'll create sales tax, lodgings tax, tourism, and it's also going to help us recruit workforce.
Yeah.
It helps change how we think of ourselves as a state.
Burgum was asked how much of the $100 million has been pledged so far.
Approximately just over half of that is what the indications have been, but none of those have been binding, and I think there was, you know, people waiting to see if the state of North Dakota, A, wanted this project and was willing to step up and support it with an endowment. And so I'd say, like, today's a starting line, not a finish line. It's a starting line for one of the most exciting fundraising campaigns in the history of North Dakota.
Randy Hotzenbuehler is the president of the Theodore Roosevelt Medora Foundation. He says this is transformational, and Hotzenbuehler says this harkens back to when Harold Schaefer took a chance and made Medora what it is.
North Dakota is a better place because of the Medora that exists today, and I'm just thrilled that there have been now people who have even bigger visions for the state than Harold did.
And as University of North Dakota President Mark Kennedy wraps up a week-long visit to the campuses of the University of Colorado, Governor Doug Burgum says it's time for Kennedy to go. Kennedy is the only finalist for that job, and Burgum says based on Kennedy's earlier application at the University of Central Florida, his tenure at UND is probably done.
It's pretty clear that he is looking for the next step up, and I know, you know, having had the opportunity to lead myself, have the opportunity to lead large, complex organizations, people look to a leader. They want to know the leader's going to be there, and it's really hard to lead a large, complex organization like a university anyway, but if all the people that are at that institution think that that leader is got one leg out the door or is looking for the next best thing, then it's almost impossible because, you know, leadership is built around trust.
Kennedy, a Republican who represented Minnesota in Congress, has been met with strong opposition from students and some faculty in Colorado for his votes on certain social issues. The Board of Regents could make a decision on the hiring next month. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. I am joined in studio by Joe Radsky. He's the news director for KVRR Television. Our Dave Thompson is in Bismarck in our studio there. He's our news director here at Prairie Public. And we've got Mike Jacobs on the phone from Gilby, North Dakota. Mike is a columnist for the Grand Forks Herald, which he was the editor and publisher of for many years before he retired. And as we were leaving the discussion to go to the news, and as the news just ended, we were reminded that higher ed is certainly a big issue. And let's just touch one more of those facets of that major issue, Dave, and that's this higher education board. What is the status of all of that now?
Well, here's what I know. There will be at least one ballot initiative on the measure to create a bigger board, but there is some thought that we may see a competing measure for multiple board, whether it be two or three boards. I'm not exactly sure. There was at least leaning toward two boards of higher education.
Well, I did hear you in an interview with Mark Hegaroth, the chancellor of the system, and you eventually got around to asking him what he thought about all these boards and whether or not one of those outcomes might mean there's no chancellor. There's somebody, some other title there.
If you look at the way the one measure was written about the larger board, that there is no chancellor of higher education, there would be a Commissioner of Higher Education, which
that's what it currently says. There's no chancellor in the Constitution now.
That's correct, yes.
So what does that mean? Does it mean anything?
That's a good question. Well, I don't know if we defined it yet.
Glad I asked it.
I did ask some people who supported it, and they said probably the power of a chancellor would be less under a multi-board situation, which I thought was kind of interesting.
Okay. Well, let's move on to another topic because, as we've heard now, the Red River is starting to move back into its banks, which is always wonderful news when the spring thaw is nearing completion. We've got this big water projects bill that was signed into law by the governor. But it has some significant funding for the FM diversion, not quite what people were hoping for.
Well, as you know, that the diversion supporters wanted an $870 million guarantee. They wanted that as legislative intent. Well, originally, as it came out, it was $703 million, but the legislature went to $750 million, and there was at first, some consternation. The governor was not happy about that. He wanted the full 870 as a way to show the P3 partners and the federal government, look, we're stepping to the plate. But he did sign the bill at $750 million. And I believe, and I've been hearing this from a number of sources, that the governor had been talking to some people about what happens if I do a line item veto. And he was told that if you do, the legislature is going to come back and say 7-3.
Uh-huh. Well, Mike, your newspaper burned down during the 1997 flood, and I was struck by what Governor Burgum said in Dave's story, that the state share of the diversion funding is less than half the cost share provided for other recently approved flood control projects. He called that a gross disparity. What's the perspective from the Northern Valley?
I would say that we want Fargo protected. But not at the expense of protection for other places in the valley. So I think that the Fargo Diversion Authority has been pretty good about working with Grand Forks to be sure that nothing that they do increases any flood threat here. I think the governor is right that Grand Forks probably got a larger state share. It also got it got a very large amount of money also from the feds which hasn't been forthcoming in the same degree in Fargo.
Mm-hmm.
And it happened, and this is an accident of geography, so to speak, that a city in Minnesota had significant damage, and so there wasn't the state, the objections coming from the state of Minnesota for the Grand Forks and East Grand Forks flood protection plan that Fargo has confronted, because Fargo is more vulnerable than Moorhead.
Well, Joe, KVRR and everybody else has been covering the rising water around us, and of course it's an annual thing almost, although this year was a little more nervous than in some more recent years. We've had 1997 and 2009, of course, are still in our memories too, but this is a very big story.
Right, and I think that Fargo and Moorhead and the area here was well-prepared and had and we didn't see the kind of flooding that maybe was anticipated, but certainly the diversion project is certainly higher on the list here than maybe it may be other places. You know, I was noted this morning as I was listening to the radio, and I know earlier this week former Governor Schaefer was critical of some of the diversion issues and everything. But one thing that stood out to me was that he mentioned the words like value engineering, and I think that goes a long way in looking at when this began and when this will actually be finished. And I think it's a very smart idea to look at the bids that are being done for construction, the bids that are being done for contractors and things like that. And I think if that is taken into the fold, I think that was one of the major takeaways I thought from former Governor Schaefer's criticism of some of it you're going to have to spend money, but spend it wisely.
Well, this is a very big ticket item. $2.75 billion is the current estimate, and of course, it's been moving since they first started talking about it. So, it's pretty dear. And if the state doesn't come through with the money, Dave, Fargo has to. Somebody's got to find it.
Somebody's got to, and that was some consternation too. Is it going to be paid for through special assessments or sales tax or what? I don't think correct me if I'm wrong, Joe, there isn't a final decision on that, but they're working on some kind of plan for alternate funding?
I think one of the plans that I've been hearing about, Joe, is that they're waiting to go back to the legislature.
I think so, yeah. Yeah, that seems to be where they're headed.
So in a couple of years, you could expect the mayor and others to be knocking at the door again, I think.
I have no doubt.
Okay. There was a kind of a sobering story in the paper today, and I'm looking at the story that was written by April Baumgarten for Forum Communications, and that was headlined, North Dakota workers dying at the second highest rate in the U.S., and almost the highest. Alaska beat us out by a tenth of a fatality per 100,000 workers, so it's a pretty close contest to see who's worst. What should we make of this?
Basically, we've known that the death rate among workers has been rising since the oil boom. And a part of that is that the ungodly truck traffic that they had in roadways that were underbuilt to serve truck traffic, so there were a lot of accidents there. And in the early days of the oil boom, they talked about fatalities in the oil fields, and a lot of them were truck drivers. And it looks like we're going back up again after maybe a couple of years where they cut the rate down.
Well, it is the nature of the industry in our state. You've got oil and gas production, you've got mining, and farming. Farming is not a safe occupation.
I think the three, statistically, the three most dangerous occupations in the United States are coal mining, oil production, and agriculture.
Yeah.
And those,
there you
those
go.
Those are the three largest,
three of our stools, basically.
Yeah, exactly. Yep.
Well, just to give our listeners a little bit of reference here, it's not like everything's going to hell in a handbasket. It's 10.1 fatalities per 100,000
mm-hmm.
workers.
That's right.
Second only behind Alaska's rate of 10.2 fatalities per 100,000 workers. But any one of those, of course, is a tragedy for that family.
Yeah, absolutely.
This marijuana decriminalization thing, David, has been bouncing back and forth and back and forth, and it sounds to me like Republican Representative Shannon Rohr Jones of Fargo is not happy with what has resulted.
No, and I know what she was trying to do. She was trying to reduce the rate of incarceration, especially for those who are caught with a small amount of marijuana, and there's been some resistance, let's put it that way, especially in the North Dakota House to that. I believe there is another bill that is coming up. They're going to try to maybe, you know, get it. I think it's in conference committee right now. They're trying to do something with it. But I know she was upset. And if you remember back, Governor Burgum said something about that maybe we should do something to decriminalize marijuana, that the case does not make them criminals but get them into treatment.
Well, the complication here, of course, is that there was an initiated measure which was not approved by voters the last time around, but it's quite likely there's going to be another.
I was going to say, I'm glad you said last time around, because we know that there will be another one.
Yeah, it would seem like at some point every state will, the country will pass this in some level at some point, based on how Colorado has handled it.
Well, and Mike, it's kind of like this is in the federal court here. I mean, this is like literally what is Congress waiting for?
Yeah. Well, it's the feds that are in the way here.
Yeah.
And
uh-huh.
And so, but you know, there doesn't seem to be any particular urgency in Congress to do anything about this. But you know, this isn't unique to North Dakota either. The marijuana initiative in the state of New Jersey, which the new governor there, Phil Murphy, was promoting, pretty much collapsed as well. I guess in every reform movement, there's sort of a start and stop kind of thing, and somebody has their feet on the brakes on this one pretty hard.
Well, do we know who those people are, Dave? I mean, obviously you know who the legislators were who voted this way or that, but is there some sort of a lobbying group? I'm not hearing a lot from law enforcement here.
No, it's not a lobbying group per se, but it's I think it's more of a philosophical argument, or basically there are some people who just don't think that we should do anything to legalize what has been known in the federal government as a Schedule I drug.
Yeah, for over 80 years, and the history around that is interesting, to say the least.
Yeah, there was an interesting piece on the morning news show on Prairie Public this morning while we were driving into the big city. actually, it was Cokie Roberts' question period.
Right, yes.
Asked Cokie, and she was explaining how this all came about.
Well, and it came about, I think, because it was sort of drummed up as a big issue back then, and here it is, just 80 years later.
And politicians of both parties rushed to be before it.
Uh-huh.
Exactly.
Or against it,
we should
say.
Well, I note also that you were mentioning other states. South Dakota, I don't think, has even picked up the medical marijuana idea yet.
Not yet.
So let's talk about a story, Dave, that we were actually talking about quite a bit last year. And I see that It's probably time to refer to it again. The new regulations for child care background checks. Remember when they had to do the fingerprinting and do all the background things, and there was a backlog, and daycare centers could not find people or couldn't guarantee that they'd have people?
Yeah, and remember, it's new federal regulations took effect that said while the potential new workers, new hires, are waiting for these background checks, they used to be able to take care of kids at daycare centers under supervision of somebody who is employed there. They took that away and they said, you have to wait until your background check comes back. And because there was such a backlog of these fingerprints and background checks at the state government, there got to be kind of a real block in terms of hiring. And I know that the child care centers were bitterly complaining about that in North Dakota. And it wasn't anything that was done at state government. It was a federal rule change. Now, apparently, there's going to be a rule change again starting in October. The federal government's going to allow this internship type thing or interim, you know, child care until the background checks are completed.
So it's the federal government acknowledging that they created a problem? Is that the issue?
I would think that's correct.
Okay.
The federal overreach, it's called.
Of course. Not unusual. Okay.
Well, you hear a lot about it, at least.
Well, here's something that used to be and is coming back maybe, Dave. The legislature is moving toward a self-insurance health plan for state employees.
Right. And if you remember, ever since Sanford got the bid from Blue Cross Blue Shield, some legislators are saying, oh, maybe it's time we ought to look at a self-insurance plan, because they've seen premiums go up, and they thought if they did self-insurance, they could have more control over premium costs and things like that. And I know Representative Carlson, when he was the majority leader, was really pushing that. And then there was a study, and they thought, well, okay, it's coming into the session. Well, Representative Carlson got defeated, and it didn't come into the session until now. They're talking about a two-year study, because in 2 years, the health insurance contract's up.
Well, I was really intrigued by a line in your story. Representative Mike LeFore of Dickinson said self-insurance is a good option. He says, what you're doing is picking a third-party administrator, LeFore said. The state actually pays the claims, saving some middleman fees. Strikes me as single payer. Sorry to throw that out there.
I never thought of that. But, yeah, it's interesting. He said it saves some middleman fees.
Yeah.
Yet we have,
which I think is used to be called the insurance company.
I think that probably is, yeah. But so, with a third-party administrator, there is some kind of oversight or middleman, perhaps.
Mm-hmm. Well, yes, and I suspect there would be in a single-payer system too, because you'd have to have some kind of administration. But that
right.
said,
and
remember, are we creeping in that direction ever so glacially?
Could be. And we also had an experience in North Dakota. For a while, the PERS plan did go a self-insurance plan. It didn't work out, and there were millions of dollars in claims that had to be paid and some things that had to be done to shore up the fund and their trust fund. But now they're saying if you do it right, this is a good option. Well, we'll see what happens at the end of the two-year study.
You know, Daniel Webster had a story just yesterday that had me scratching my head a little bit. The Senate votes for Social Security income tax credits. How is that? How does that work? I don't understand that.
Well, in North Dakota, we tax Social Security.
I know that.
And we're one of just a few states that tax it at the federal rate. And what they're trying to do is say, okay, there's a federal tax on it. Is there a way that the legislature can basically say, if you're a Social Security recipient, you don't have to pay taxes? Well, there's a bill that's going to go part of the way there. You know, there's a limit about, you know, if you're above an income threshold, you're going to have to pay something.
So, but clarify for me, if I have to pay something on my Social Security tax, how can I apply that as a credit? I don't quite get that.
I think you either are going to deduct your Social Security income from the bottom line of your income.
That's okay. What I understood.
Okay.
Yes.
Well,
yeah, I think that's what they're going to do. Or you may get a credit back on the tax that you pay federally You could work that way as well.
So either way, I come out ahead.
Well, you should come out ahead, yeah.
Okay, fair enough.
That's why I needed the clarification. Don't cash your check until it's delivered.
I hear you. Believe me, I understand that. There was an interesting story, and I did not realize it was this serious, Dave, that they need prosecutors, especially in western North Dakota.
Right now there are 6 prosecutors down in Burley County, 5 in Minot and in Ward County. And part of the reason is the crime rate has gone up as the population has gone up in western North Dakota, and there's burnout. And they said it's not so much the salaries. The salaries are decent, but there's burnout. And then if you have open positions, well, other people are picking up the work, and that causes more burnout. And I'm trying to research this. I've heard anecdotally that, you know, there people going into the law profession, the numbers are down.
Yeah.
So I want to get a little handle on that too.
Well, I'm curious about this burnout thing, because if they had those 6 more in Burley County or wherever, that the workload would be such that there wouldn't be burnout, I take
that's,
it?
That's the at least the theory.
Okay.
The legislature put quite a bit of money into changing the formula for the way that the law school is funded at UND. So there'll be more faculty and I think it's 3 more. They got 3 more lines in the new formula.
Right, right.
So that's a kind of reaction to the shortage of prosecutors. The other big shortage in North Dakota is that we don't have as many oil attorneys as we really need, given the pace of oil development in the state.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's finish our roundtable with a discussion of the great big pot of money that the state is accumulating called the Legacy Fund. And that's going to be studied some more, Dave?
It is. There were proposals to do something with the Legacy Fund. One proposal was to basically plow the profits back into the Legacy Fund. And to access the principal Legacy Fund takes a 2/3 vote. Well, that was turned into a study. So. And then there was a proposal to use part of the Legacy Fund to buy down state income taxes. But the going feeling in talking to leadership in the legislature is that they'd like to reserve those profits for one-time things like roads and bridges, buildings, that type of thing.
There was actually a proposal to use some of the Legacy Fund to build a Roosevelt Library.
That is correct, yes.
And that is the – you know, the sort of this one-time project idea is put out there. There's an idea maybe we should build roads with it and, mm-hmm. you know, because we're not collecting enough gas tax, or maybe get rid of the income tax with it. Joe, what do people in your newsroom think about this?
Well, no, as Dave writes here, as Senator Cook mentions, that's something that will benefit everybody. That's going to be the struggle, right? I mean,
yeah.
What will everybody believe in?
Well, I was intrigued by this because when they were setting up the Legacy Fund, one of the countries they were looking to for some guidance or experience was Norway,
mm-hmm.
which I believe now has a fund from their oil and gas development that is approaching $8 trillion.
Right, right.
And, I mean, at what point do you just, you know, okay, the country's running itself now. We got a $1 trillion endowment.
Pretty much. And in Norway, it's called the Norwegian Retirement Fund Global. That's the actual title of it. But it basically takes care of everything. I mean, the Norwegians, as I understand it, do not pay income taxes.
Well.
One of the things that they might consider is repaying the Common Schools Trust Fund for the mistake that
yes.
was made in shorting it all of these years, so that the general fund money was going to support the Common Schools Trust Fund, and other priorities in the state were pushed back in order to avoid a bigger budget crisis.
Well, we'll have to leave it
with
budget,
that. The budget crisis turns out to have been at least partly human error.
Okay. Mike Jacobs is the Grand Forks Herald columnist, former editor and publisher of that paper. Thanks for joining us from Gilby today, Mike.
You bet. Thank you.
Dave Thompson, our Prairie Public News Director in Bismarck. Thank you, Dave.
Thank you, Doug.
And Joe Radsky, KVRR Television News Director. Thank you for being with me here in Fargo studio.
My pleasure.
All right. Dakota Datebook is next.
When you hear arts programming here on Prairie Public, know that it is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, and we thank them.
This is Dakota Datebook for April 26th. Today is National Arbor Day, but many states observe Arbor Day on different dates based on the best tree planting times. North Dakota's Arbor Day comes a week from now, the first Friday in May. Only Alaska and Maine have later dates in May, and some southern states observe Arbor Day in November, December, or even January. From its first days, Dakota Territory had a notable need for trees to supply lumber, fuel, and shelter. In 1862, the Homestead Act had invited settlers to populate public land. That was followed in 1873 by the Timber Culture Act, another way to claim 160 acres of land. These tree claims required trees to be planted on 40 of the 160 acres. After 10 years, each of those 40 acres had to have at least 2,700 trees. 625 had to be alive and thriving. In cases of extreme drought, grasshopper infestation, or other natural disasters, homesteaders could get extensions. Later amendments lowered the number of acres required from 40 to 10, and the number of years from 10 to 8. Any U.S. citizen over 21 could file tree claims, except married women, unless they could prove they were the heads of their households. But an 1875 ruling stated that a single woman with a tree claim wouldn't have to give it up if she got married, as long as she still fulfilled the requirements. When the conditions were met, the applicant and two credible witnesses made affidavits. A $10 fee was paid, and the deal was done. The applicant owned the land, along with its timber. Many people signed on for tree claims because there was no requirement to live on that land, but not many succeeded. Timber claims were more work, more expensive, and more trouble than regular claims. Plus, it took only 5 years to prove up on cultivated claims. In the end, many tree claims were abandoned, and in 1891, the Timber Culture Act was repealed. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Mary Helm. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Basin Electric Power Cooperative of Bismarck, a Touchstone Energy Cooperative, producing reliable electricity for 141-member rural electric systems in 9 states.
I'm Peter Sagal. Studies show that the secret to human happiness is a spiffy new car. No, really, it's science. So when it's time to trade up for bliss, donate your used car to us, and we'll turn it into the programs you love.
Just call 844-440-6900 or visit us online at prairiepublic.org/car.
Monday on Main Street, we'll hear about the Hunger Free North Dakota Coalition's efforts to sustain the summer food service program, which offers lunches for kids when school is out. We'll talk about it with Linda Schlor, who's with the North Dakota Department of Public Instruction, and the USDA's Melissa Anderson. We hope you can join us for Main Street on Monday. We hope you'll check out Main Street Weekend, Sunday morning at 10 Central. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.